Shabbat Shalom, everybody. Boker Tov. Good morning. And this is, as you've probably already gathered, this is one of those portions that I also love because there is so much meat in it. As a matter of fact, I guess if you were to dig in and say, where's kind of meat central? It begins in about chapter 4 of the book of Devarim, of Deuteronomy. Now, there's another thing here I want to point out as well, and I hammered on this last night, and I'm going to do some things that are a little bit different today. If you're looking for another overview of the complete portion, I generally try to do that on Erev Shabbat. What I'm going to do today is focus on a couple of specific areas, and I'm actually going to begin a little bit differently as well with what I will call a warp drive tour of the portion. Because really what we're going to say, so far as what Deuteronomy 4, 5, 6, and 7 are concerned with in particular, is there are certain words that appear over and over and over again. This is a really good place to learn some Hebrew. Of course, one of them you no doubt already know, and that is shamar, or in the case as it's conjugated in places like Deuteronomy 6, 4, shema. So it's the same root word, means literally hear, but it also means hear and obey. This is one of the places where I don't have too much of a problem with the King James English, because there's a word we don't use anymore. Maybe it's because it means shamar. It's hearken. Hearken means don't just listen, darn it, go do it. And that is the key to all of this. You're going to find that that is the essence of a Hebraic mindset. Don't just tell me you hear me. If you do it, then I know you're really listening. So we're going to see that. By the way, the other word there is asah, and that is the Hebrew word for do. And then there are a couple, three or four more that we're going to see in this portion. Some of them you've heard me talk about because I like to hammer on them over and over again too. It's chuk, or the plural, chukim. Statutes and judgments and commandment, mishpot, mitzvotim, mishpatim, all of those words that mean statutes and judgments and commandments and ordinances. When you put all of that stuff together and you add in another word we're going to see in this portion today, which is testimonies and things like parables too, then you end up with Torot, the collection of all the instructions, which together, I guess you could say, literally make up his Torah. So understand, I'm one of these people that gets kind of irritated at having Torah translated as law. It's not a horrible translation, it's just misleading. Because we then can believe things like the asinine, stupid, ridiculous comment, the law is done away with. Well, if the law was done away with, all of our bodies would have floated off into space long ago, because the law of gravity is part of his instruction. Really, what it is the very fabric of the universe, the way that he made things to be, those are the things that physicists properly describe as law. Evolution, you'll note, is not a law, it's a theory, because it actually doesn't have real-world application. So it's just something somebody made up to try and explain laws that they aren't willing to admit come from him. So let's go through this again at warp speed, just to kind of get an understanding of why it is I'm saying these concepts are so important, and here's the real key, they are so repeated. And in doing this, I'm going to start with, chapter 4, verse 1. It says, now, O Israel, oh, here's the first one, hearken, shema, et what, or unto what? Well, ha-chukim, va-et ha-mishpatim, in other words, the statutes and the ordinances and all of these things which I teach you so that you can go asa, do them, that you might live. And then possess the land which Yahuwah, Elohim of your fathers, is giving to you. Now, verse 2 is one that also bears repeating. And it really, as has already been pointed out today, it only gets repeated one time here. By the way, if you're curious, does it ever show up in the New Testament? That way we know it really counts. Yeah, it's the very, very last commandment in all of Scripture in the book of Revelation. It says the same thing. Don't do this. Otherwise, your portion in the book of life gets removed. So verse 4:2 says this, and this is one of those I would encourage people memorize. At least get the gist of it and be able to point people. Deuteronomy 4:2. That's not too hard to remember. The other one, by the way, is Deuteronomy 12:32. Last part of chapter 12, right before we hear all about what false prophets do and how we can recognize them and what we're supposed to do about them. Isn't it interesting that all of this goes together? So 4:2 says you're not to add unto the word. There's that word, and it's debar in this case, word, which I command you. It's the same thing that we see in the 10 debarim, or sayings, or words. Neither shall you diminish from. So, you're not to add to or subtract from in modern English. That you might keep, what? Yeah, shamar, the commandments of Elohim. Yahuwah, your Elohim, Eloheka, which I command you. And then he goes on to say, you've seen all these things that happened. You all are alive because you cleave. And then Moshe goes on. So here's the warp drive part. Let's just talk about some of the places where over and over again we see references to statutes, ordinances, commandments, and do them. Shamar them, observe them, keep them. Verse 5, behold, I've taught you statutes and ordinances, even as Yahuwah commanded me, so that you can do so. In the midst of the land you go into possess. Observe, keep, shamar, do this. For this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the peoples. That when they hear all these things, they'll say, surely this is a great nation and a wise and understanding people. The idea there is if they see that you do these things, then it's very clear in the sight of these peoples what that wisdom is. What great nation is there that has these, again, statutes and ordinances, so righteous? And that word there, righteous, is zadik. The wise one who is a zadik, who's learned in the ways of righteousness, who does, who keeps, obeys, shamars, all of these statutes and judgments and commandments, this Torah, which I set before you this day. Verse 14, Yahuwah commanded me at the time to teach you statutes and ordinances, that you might do them. There's another thing that's going to show up here, but we're at warp drive, so we'll come back and get it. Has to do with this idea of a graven image or a likeness of things. Now, that's going to be important, so we'll come back to that one again. I call heaven and earth to witness. If you don't do these things, you'll utterly perish. You'll be driven out of the land. You'll be scattered among the peoples, and there you will serve other gods. But if you seek him with your whole heart, you'll find him in your distress when the end of days are come. And that's an interesting one, too. Then you will return and do what? Shamar, hearken unto his voice. Know this day that he, Yahuwah, is Elohim. Heaven above and upon the earth beneath there is no one else. And so what? Verse 40. You shall keep shamar, his statutes, his hukim, his judgments, and his commandments, which I command you this day. Verse 45, these are the testimonies, the statutes, and the ordinances which Moshe spoke unto the children of Israel. On into chapter 5. Now, you know that chapter 5 is the second place we're going to hear what they refer to in English mostly as the Ten Commandments, the ten words, sayings, Debarim. Moshe called unto all Israel. What's the first words he says? Hear, Shema, Israel. What's her? What are they supposed to hear? Statutes and ordinances, which I speak in your ears this day. So what? So that you might learn them and observe, shamar, to do them. And then follows the listing. Now, because we're at warp drive, we're going to come back in a second. I'm going to dwell on some of these commandments in a second. But let's stay. Finish up this theme. Chapter 6 begins. Now, this is the commandment, the statutes, and the ordinances which Yahuwah has commanded to teach you. Again, so that you might go into the land and possess it. Are you beginning to get the idea that he feels it's necessary? Perhaps because you can look at the church today and modern Western society today, or indeed the whole world today, and realize people are stiff-necked still, and they won't listen. And they will tell you all this stuff is done away with, and it's old. Well, there might be a few of these that were repeated in the New Testament, but we pretty well ignore those too, just like we ignore the Sabbath and all of those other things that we find inconvenient nowadays. This is the statutes, the ordinances, the commandments, chapter 6, verse 1, that you might fear Yahuwah to keep his statutes and his commandments, which I command you and your son's son. The theme here, of course, is it's not just about you. It's about you and your son and your grandchildren on down. Teach them all so that they can teach down the line. So that your life might be prolonged. Your days might be prolonged. Verse 3, hear, therefore, Israel, hear, hearken, and obey, Shema, again, O Israel, and observe to do this, that it might be well with you. And then, of course, in verse 4 of chapter 6 is, sometimes you'll hear this called the greatest commandment, the primary commandment, the golden commandment. If there are 10 of the other ones, then this is a wonderful summary. Hear, O Israel, Yahuwah Eloheka, Yahuwah Echad. You shall love Yahuwah Eloheka, the Lord your God, with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. And these words, which I command you today, shall be upon your heart, and you shall diligently teach them unto your children. Meditate on them, talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, lie down, rise up. Bind them as a sign on your hand. Let them be as frontlets before your eyes. Write them on the doorpost of your house and on your gates, so that when Yahuwah brings you into this land that he swore to your fathers, all this good stuff will befall you. Beware lest you forget who it was brought you up out of bondage. Fear him. By him you shall swear. Don't go after other gods, the gods of the people that are around you. Verse 17, so diligently keep the commandments of Yahuwah Eloheka. His statutes, his testimonies, all these things that he has commanded you, and do that which is right and good in the sight of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. When your son asks you, what does all this mean, these testimonies, these statutes, these ordinances which he's commanded us, then you're to say, and here you've heard the story. It's the same story, essentially, as the Passover. We were once bondmen, slaves, in Mitzrayim or Egypt, and Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh brought us out with a mighty hand, and he showed us all these signs and wonders. He laid Pharaoh low. He gave us what he had swore to give us, and, verse 24, he commanded us to do all these statutes for our good always. It is zadika, righteousness unto us, if we will do these things. And then in chapter 7. Now, chapter 7 is interesting. It's going to talk about the statutes and judgments and commandments, but it also has some interesting comments. Now, because we're at warp speed, we'll come back to some of this, and I'm going to then take a second pass through here and pick up these other things. Verse 11, don't fall victim to all of these fake gods that are going to be in this land. There's a lot on that. That's what we're going to come back to. But, therefore, people that do this, people that serve these others, they hate Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. Well, he keeps covenant with them that love him and keep his commandments to 1,000 generations. But those that hate him, they will be repaid. He won't be slack to them. He will repay them to his face. So therefore, you, y'all, who love him and keep his commandments, shall, say it with me, keep the commandments, the statutes, and the ordinances to do them. And that literally is where this parsha ends. There's a couple of interesting things in there that we will no doubt come back to simply because they follow from this other stuff. But here's where I want to add a couple of other things in specific now that I want to focus on a bit more. Deuteronomy 4:2 obviously is one of them. You're not to add to nor subtract from this word, this debar. Now, what does the word word mean, right? Oh, well, that's a four-letter word, means a symbol used to replace, a concept so that we can communicate with one another. Okay. On the other hand, didn't he speak the whole world into existence? Matter of fact, if you read some of the Midrashim, you will see that one of the things that it says in Genesis, when the Ruach of life was breathed in and Adam became a living nefesh being, in some cases, there's a pretty good case to be made that he became a being empowered with speech, a speaking being. In other words, I think there's more to this concept of the word than maybe we have, at least in standard English parlance, been led to believe. And I've already alluded to the fact, well, what is law? The physicist, I contend, has a better handle on the meaning of the word law than the lawyer does, for crying out loud, or the politician. They ignore it completely. And ultimately, in physics, a law is something that is always true. In other words, it is a facet of the way God made the universe. Law of gravity, primary example. Second, law of thermodynamics. These are things that every single time, I mean every single time without exception, when a scientist runs an experiment or makes an observation, it is true. You can literally bet your life on it. You can stake your life on the fact that gravity works. Matter of fact, whether you know it or not, we are. If gravity didn't work, we'd be spinning off into space and we'd find it difficult to breathe anyway because the atmosphere would have been gone too. So these laws, his true word, is something we can count on. And in fact, we have to. Our very lives depend on it. And that's part and parcel of what I want to make sure we talk about today. But now let's pass. 4-2, don't add to or subtract from. We got this idea. All these statutes and judgments and commandments and testimonies, Torot, instructions, together they make up all his Torah, which, again, I think is even bigger, if you will, than Scripture. Why do I say that? Now, I'm not talking about oral Torah and some of those kind of things. I'm just simply referring to the fact that even before it was written down, there were certain things that, well, let's put it the way the founders once did. There are certain truths we hold to be self-evident. Certain parts, even, of the Ten Commandments are pretty clear. Most people will accept that you shouldn't murder. Thou shalt not steal doesn't hold quite the level of reverence in most of the world. Hey, if you're a Congress critter and if 51% of the people tell you it's okay to steal, why then it's okay. We can institutionalize that. And as for thou shalt not commit adultery, well, it depends, I guess. If you're a high enough level, then it's okay. First night and so forth. I wish I wasn't being sarcastic. I wish, I wish I was merely being sarcastic, those things aren't true. In other words, we've come to the point where there are certainly a lot of people, just as we finished reading at the end of that section, that do seem to hate him. They not only don't keep his commandments, they seem to actually derive a certain amount of sadistic pleasure out of hating them and not keeping him. And maybe that's why it is that we're getting to the point, and we're going to talk about this when we talk about the news, to the fact that there are those who are not faithful to him. They do not keep covenant with him. And he will repay those who hate them face to face to destroy them. He won't be slack with them. It would seem so far that, you know, where's the promise of his coming? It's been a while. But I suspect we're getting closer. And we're going to talk about all of those things in a couple minutes because it helps this piece to fit together. Well, second pass through this thing, what I wanted to focus on this time was this idea, again, of idolatry. And yeah, this is something that you literally can't miss if you go through this portion. It is one of the things, however, that the church and so many of those that, whether they acknowledge it or not, seem to at least ignore what he has written, will particularly ignore this part. Take heed, says Moshe. Now, this is back in chapter 4, verse 19. They're fixing to go into the land. Take heed, lest you forget this brit, this covenant of Yahuwah, which he's made with you, and make yourselves a graven image, even the likeness. Now, here's two more words we're going to talk about today. So let's go there right away, and then we'll come back to this part, too, because, again, if there's another thing that you can learn and teach in this portion, it's that repetition really does matter. He lays these concepts out, and he lays them out, and he lays them out, and he repeats them, and he circles back on them so that we can finally begin to understand what it is that he's talking about here. The two words are these. The first word is this word that gets translated as don't make yourself a graven image. Now, we tend to think, oh, this is from the Ten Commandments. And indeed, that is the very first place. It's Exodus. First time we see the Ten Commandments, chapter 20 of Exodus. Exodus 4. 24. I'll say it twice so that I get it right. Exodus chapter 20, verse 4. And that word, and I don't very often give you the Strong's numbers, but I will in this case. If you want to write it down, it's worth doing. It's H6459, and it's Pesel. Pesel. Now, the funny thing is, pretty much, if you say, well, what is a graven image? it's always used in the same context. You can search through here, and it shows up in Exodus 20, chapter verse 4, Leviticus 26, 1, and Deuteronomy 4, 16, and 4, 23, and 4, 25. It's all in this section here. Take heed, lest you forget the covenant of Yahuwah, which he made with you, and make a graven image, even the likeness of anything which he's forbidden you. Well, then later on, he's going to say, don't make a graven image in the form of or the likeness of anything. It only gets used in that one way. So what does it mean? Well, I'm going to suggest something in just a minute that I hope may help expand on that a little bit. It was actually something which I don't very often say this, but I'm going to come right out and say it. I think this was given to me by inspiration. Been praying about it and thinking about those words. It's bugged me for a long time. And I'm going to suggest something in the context of today's news. I'll phrase it in the form of a question when we get there and see if it makes sense to you. Graven image. Because people will ask this question, right? Well, you know, I've got a picture of my dog on the wall. Got a picture of my my departed son who was killed in Vietnam. Is that okay? Can I have that? Do I need to decide? I really love that picture. It's the only thing I've got to remember him by. Or various other ones that are departed. Or pets that are gone. Can we have any of that stuff? It's tough. Most people are in modern America will have photographs and pictures and things. I don't necessarily think that that's what it's talking about here. And I'm going to suggest that I knew that there is one other thing that it is talking about. But before we get there, let's go to this other word too, which also appears in the same context. Don't make yourselves a graven image or the likeness of anything. Now, that word likeness is temunah. And it's, by the way, since I'm carrying out this pattern here, it's H, the Hebrew lexicon, 8544. So Strong's H8544, likeness. It means form or image or likeness or representation or resemblance. Other places it gets translated similitude. Now, this word, at least, does appear in one other or two other places. Numbers 12, where it talks about, I spoke, this is Moshe dressing down his brother and sister. I speak with Moshe face to face is the context. And it uses the word similitude there, which is this word temunah. But as a general rule, with those just very few exceptions, these words appear together, and they appear in the very same places, all having to do with graven images and the likeness of something on the heavens above or in the earth or in the waters beneath. And you'll see them over and over again together, like in Exodus 20, verse 4. And in Deuteronomy, in this chapter 4 place, where they appear about 3 times. And then, of course, once again in the Ten Commandments. All right, I've been alluding to this. Let's go to it. We can see that the other place it tells us we're not to do this, of course, is in this repetition of the Ten Commandments in Deuteronomy chapter 5. Anki Yahuwah Elohecha, I am the Lord your God, is how King James rendered it, who brought you out of bondage. Have no other Elohim, I like to say fake gods, before me, before my face, really. Al pani, before my face, or in my face. I do think that's a pretty good rendering of it. You don't shove these other fake gods in my face, for crying out loud. Even the metaphor makes sense to us today. And then it says, you shall not make a graven image or any manner of temunah, likeness of anything that is in the heavens above or the earth beneath or in the water under the earth. Then it goes on, don't bow down to them, serve them, for I am a jealous Elohim. And probably you know the rest of it. But let's pause there and kind of fill in a couple of other gaps. Because between this place in chapter 4 of Deuteronomy, where he says, the first time, don't forget yourselves, don't fall into this trap, don't make a graven image. I call heaven and earth to witness. If you do this, you'll perish. You won't prolong your days in the land. I'll scatter you among the peoples, and you will serve other gods, the work of men's hands. Wood and stone. which you neither see nor hear nor smell nor eat. Wood and stone. Now, what was Adam made out of? Adam was made out of what? Soil, dirt, clay? Wood and stone. It occurs to me in the context of what I'm fixing to lay out here that stone, at least, is a little bit like dirt. I guess you could say it's harder. It's hard dirt. And wood, on the other hand, at least at one time, was alive. So wood, nowadays in a modern scientific parlance, we'd say, well, that has a cellular structure. And by the way, if there are questions that come up, see them on there. We'll try to save those, and I'll come back to them, or some of them I'll get in as we go through here. But by all means, as always, I really expect there may be some questions today. What I'm fixing to lay out, and yeah, I know I'm laying a lot of stuff out first. I think it'll make more sense if I do. But I suspect it'll raise some eyebrows. Now, it may not be all that shocking, but as I thought about it more, the more I thought it began to fill in, connect a bunch more dots. In particular, with what we're seeing today. So concentrate a little bit for a second on this idea of Adam was made out of dirt, or soil, or stone, or clay, and here we've got these other gods. They're kind of like a similitude, a little bit like a tamuna, a likeness, only they're made out of not clay or dirt, but of stone, really hard dirt, and maybe wood, which kind of has a cellular structure. At least it's a bit like Adam, too. But they do have this in common. They neither see, nor hear, nor eat, nor smell. If you fall into this trap, you end up serving people who serve those things. You fall into the trap, you worship the gods, is kind of what it's saying. If you make these things, the likeness of these things. But then, again, you go into bondage. There you serve other gods, the work of men's hands, and because those gods also command the men, then you end up being slaves to those. Know that there's no one else beside him. So we go to chapter 5. We see this, thou shalt not make a graven image again. And now let's tie things with the end of the portion by going all the way into chapter 7. Okay, we skip through the part where it says, hear, O Israel, Yahuwah Eloheka, Yahuwah Echad, he is one. Know that, understand that, keep his commandments. When we tie the... Now, so this is one of those places where you get this Akbash, kind of. It's a pattern that repeats in a bookend form. So we got like an open parenthesis and a closed parenthesis. Chapter 7, I think, is at least part of the open parenthesis. Don't fall into this trap. Don't fall into this trap of worshiping these other gods. How do we avoid it? Chapter 7 tells us. When Yahuwah Eloheka delivers these nations, these seven nations mightier than you, up before you, you are to smite them, utterly destroy them, do not make a covenant with them, not even to show mercy, don't make marriages with them, don't give your sons to their daughters and vice versa, because all of that is part and parcel of this trap. You fall into this trap. If you do, it will turn your son, your daughter, away from following me. They'll serve other gods. And so the anger of Yahuwah will be kindled against you quickly. So what is it we're supposed to do? Listen to this. Here's how you're to deal with them, says verse 5. Deuteronomy 7, verse 5. Here's how you're to deal with them. You shall break down their altars, dash in pieces their pillars, hew down their asherim, their groves of phallic-like trees, burn their graven images with fire. Can you kind of sense the consistent pattern there? Smash, destroy, tear down, burn. I think we get the gist of it. He doesn't like these things. We are to, well, we're to cleanse them utterly. Cleanse with fire, cleanse with burning. I guess you'd say if we had antibiotics, we'd use those too, right? For you're a set apart people unto Yahuwah. He didn't choose you because you were more in number, although there are more of you now than there were. He's keeping the oath that he swore to your fathers. Know, therefore, that he is who he says he is. He is Elohim, the faithful Elohim, who keeps his covenant, the covenant, and has mercy with them that love him and keep his commandments. Those he hates, those that hate him, will repay, they will get repaid by him, literally before their faces. So keep these things and do them. All right. So there's all the pattern and the background. Let's go back again to this idea of making a graven image. Let me suggest to you, now maybe some of you had already figured it out. Hopefully you have. What about DNA? Think about that for a second. Now, we know about DNA, and that was a Nobel Prize winning discovery not too many years back. You talk 100 years ago, DNA is completely outside of people's kin. As an engineer, I will tell you that when I started studying modulation codes and information theory, how do you send information through a wire or through space or store it on a computer? I worked in disk drive and tape drive development for most of my career and doing things that I even have a patent on a modulation code that has to do with storing information on an optical disk. Okay, and studied things like Shannon's sampling theorem and Shannon's channel capacity theory. How much information, how many bits can you shove through a wire? Remember, some of us know the days when 300 bits per second was a big deal. And now we're talking megabits or gigabits per second data transmission rates. This is all exciting, interesting stuff. It's all about how much man has learned about transmitting information and storing and retrieving information. Let me tell you, folks, the thing that impressed me as a young engineer was, we don't know squat. Okay? Binary codes have basically ones and zeros. Most people know that. And in the DNA, you have a code, this double helix, that contains... I'm going to be out of my depth pretty quick here, but ACHT, I think it is, or ACST. Anyway, there are four. Now, it's not just a on-off bit kind of a thing. Literally, there are four elements that make up the DNA code in this ladder structure. And all the DNA, by the way, is always spinning the same way. You'd think if it was randomly evolved, we'd have DNA that goes right-handed and left-handed both, but we don't. Interesting. And by the way, DNA isn't any good. You need a secret encoder ring and a secret decoder ring in order to take DNA and get the information in and out. It's a bit like saying to me, if somebody developed a massive disk drive and we just laid this disk drive in the dirt, eventually, out of pure chance, would come along a disk drive reader. You know, rain, sun, a little bit of primordial muck thrown in the mix, and pretty soon, shazam, you'd be reading this. Bull. DNA is about the best evidence you will ever find that there is a creator, and he's a hell of a lot smarter than any of us are. What am I getting at here? Well, is it too much of a stretch? I've already talked about this idea of Deuterium, words. He spoke the word into existence. Word is what? Word is a way of transferring information. Organizing information. Think about it. What is speech? Speech is organizing information in a way to transmit it. I'll ask it as a question, like I promised I would. Is DNA a part of his word? Is the basic building block of life, the deoxyribonucleic acid structure that marks every single living thing and transmits all of our information from father to son to son to son through the seed, seed that replicates after its own kind, seed that mankind has been trying to make a similitude, a tamuna, a form, an image, a likeness, a representation of, and twist it. Are there some patterns that are starting to emerge from all of this? Don't worship their fickle, capricious, lying Elohim or gods. What is it that this whole section pretty much starts off with? Chapter 4:2. I'm going to come back to this, as I said. You shall not add to the debar, which I command you, nor shall you diminish from it, that you may keep the commandments of Yahuwah Eloheka. Is it too much of a leap to say, you shall not add to or subtract from the DNA, the word, which I give you? Remember the other verse that you might know? The life is in the blood. I've got that up on my screen here somewhere. Where does it say the life is in the blood? The Dom. Well, one place is Leviticus chapter 17. Let me just read that quickly. It's verse 11. For the life of all flesh. And by the way, in this case, the word life is not chai, it's nefesh. The living life force. Remember, animals have nefesh. They have life too. For the life of the flesh, basar, is in the dam, the blood. And I've given it to you upon the altar to make atonement for your souls. For it is the blood that makes atonement for the soul. That word again is nefesh. These connections, they're downright fascinating. Is it just possible that in the Torah, in His instruction for us, in the very way that He has encoded the universe, that there is more information than men, brilliant as they think they are, have just barely begun to understand? Maybe part of the reason He tells us not to add to or subtract from is because we ain't smart enough. We can see what happens to a church that adds and subtracts to His word for 1,700 years and what a mess it is. We get to the point where we say, oh, well, I guess if His word isn't the same yesterday and today and tomorrow, and we can ignore that, why can't we ignore a few things like the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and the supreme law of the land? We got men that think they're above all of that. We shouldn't be surprised. We got men that think they are better than God. They can improve on what He made. They can take His cell structure and say, oh, there's all this unneeded information in this DNA. Well, we don't need that. And we can create, we'll mix a little bit of pig genes in with this. We'll take some spider genes and put them in with these tomatoes. We'll create Roundup-resistant veggies. Now, they may cause death in all kinds of people. They may cause your immune system to be exceptionally vulnerable to other infections later on. But hey, who cares? We got other gods today that will tell you what really matters. Forget Yahuwah Rapha. You see how I'm beginning to say all of this does fit together? Let's go back to the Ten Commandments. Anki Yahuwah Eloheka. I am who I say I am. I brought you out of bondage. I can take you back. The very next words are, you are not to make a graven image, even any manner of likeness, similitude, form, image. So you're not to make a pasel, whatever the heck a pasel is. Don't make a pasel or in the likeness, the tumuna of anything, period, that is in the heavens above, the earth beneath, or the water under the earth. Now, I think we understand the context of verse 7 here. This is talking about living things. These idols, that generally, they can't talk, they can't speak, but usually we think about them as being fish gods or, centaur-looking things or even things with wings or whatever. Maybe somebody hanging on a cross. We're not supposed to make a likeness of any such thing. All right? Is a statue a likeness? Is a picture a likeness? Maybe. But let me just cut to the chase. If you think a statue or a picture is a likeness, well, for crying out loud, how about if you take the basic building blocks that we now know, we didn't even know about this stuff 100 years ago, that we now know, maybe they knew about it in the time of Noah. Isn't that interesting? Anyway, and we will make we'll take a tomato and we'll make a better tomato. That tomato is not as good as our tomato. We will now create, we can do human beings. We might even be able to get them to think they have a nefesh, but I don't know if we can put a neshama in there or not. You think people are being cloned today? I guarantee you. It's been happening. There are labs all over the world doing it. And there are those that haven't maybe yet done it, but they're certainly trying it. And Monsanto has patents. And by the way, so does the CDC, interestingly enough, on Ebola. Isn't that interesting? Making a likeness of something that is designed to do nothing but kill. It's almost like there's a trap here, isn't there? People can not only go back into bondage, but they die. I think the patterns and the connections here go way beyond, and they'll help to flesh out what it is that he's talking about. Just maybe there's a reason we're told don't make a graven image. We don't even know what a graven image is. A likeness? It somehow or other resembles something that's in the heavens above or the earth walking around with us or in the waters below. What's the real key? Well, again, I'm not saying that this is precisely what it's talking about, but I am saying this. The way I now understand this is if there is a prohibition against making a picture of something or a statue that looks like something, for crying out loud, how much more so, this is the Hebrew heavy and the light, how much more so the very thing which represents the structure, the word that brings forth in the image of its creator and in the image of the seed that brought it forth, the very thing itself. If the life of the flesh is in the blood, and you're not supposed to drink that or mess with that, then how much more so the DNA? We don't know what the meaning of that word graven really is, pisel. But on the other hand, for thousands of years, while scholars have been studying this, they didn't understand, they wouldn't have known what DNA, or deoxyribonucleic acid, or a double helix, or even information theory was either. They might have had an understanding about, well, you can transmit information with words. And in the DNA, we now know, are at least four different kinds of words which make up the language and the structure of the thing that transmits the essence of life. What happens? Let me ask one other question, I guess, to try and connect some of these dots here. I think some of this hopefully is becoming clear. Is DNA essence of, part of, is it included within this understanding of His Word? If we're not to make a likeness of it, well, then why does it say also, doesn't this make sense? You are not to add to or subtract from the Word that I command you, so that you can keep the commandments of Yahuwah Eloheka. If we're not to add to or subtract from things like keeping His Sabbath, changing times and seasons, calling what He calls abomination, abomination, or saying it's okay, or even mandating that you have to do it, how much more so if His very Deborim is the essence of life itself? Don't be mucking with His instructions for creation of life. And for you and your structure, life is in the blood. Not supposed to eat it. If you kill an animal in order to eat it, you pour the blood out on the ground. I guess if you pour the blood out on the ground, it's kind of difficult to harvest its DNA, isn't it? Is GMO'd DNA an idol? That's where I'm heading. Don't make a graven image. If you genetically modify corn or soybeans or people, or fish, or dogs, or birds, or viruses, can it become an idol? Well, let's put it this way. If, as I tend to think, there is a lot of evidence, I'm not scientifically astute enough in that particular field to say that Ebola is a genetically modified bioweapon, but I'll tell you what, folks, I believe that it is. I've seen enough evidence to personally convince me that it is. Something that deadly doesn't happen by accident. It needs to be carefully honed in order to achieve that kind of mortality and transmissibility. We've known for a long time that, of course, the reason, I won't say the reason, I'll say that one of the characteristics of not food, like pork, this is something that helped convince me of the truth of His Deborim, His Torah, a long time ago, is that pork, because its DNA is very, very close to that of mankind, is an animal that which almost all the diseases that will infect and kill pork can jump the species barrier to man. So what is it that biologists and other genetically modified Franken creators have been doing for a long time? They say, well, you want to create a really effective bioweapon. Why, you start with something that you splice some pig DNA into. How about bird flu? See, bird flu doesn't generally easily jump the species barrier, but if we genetically modify it, mix in some pig stuff with it, we can turn it into a super weapon that will now jump the species barrier and have the kind of lethality that we can get with birds, but the kind of transmissibility we get with pigs. Aren't we smart? Aren't we Elohim? Oh, yeah! In His image? Now, in our image, we are creating life, or even death. What was it that Oppenheimer or one of those said at the Manhattan Project? I am become, oh, whatever the name of that Indian god was. destroyer of worlds. There are a lot of people. Well, I guess the bottom line, folks, is this. Don't ever think for a second that Jeremiah wasn't right. Human heart is desperately wicked. Who can know it? It strikes me as interesting, too. We're also told about not making marriages with sons. And I guess we're not supposed to make marriages with things that aren't really even DNA. Shiva, thank you. I am become Shiva, destroyer of lives. All right, so I've been talking to Dad. This is the essential thing that I want to start with. Because for years, literally, every time we come through this Torah portion, I will focus on Deuteronomy 4:2. Don't add to or subtract from. Deuteronomy 12:32 says the same thing. And as I've just mentioned a while back in Revelation, the very last commandment in Scripture, it's a repetition. If you add to or subtract from, you're part in the book of life. Interesting, isn't it? We'll be added to or subtracted from too. One more suggestion. I saw a story this week. And you know, it kind of makes sense. I'm not necessarily hammering explicitly on the scientists. I actually worked with some of these people at places like Yorktown Research when I was an IBM engineer years ago. I'd go to Yorktown Research several times some pretty neat stuff going on there. But one of the things that they're all excited about now is a brain, a cyber brain based on a likeness, similitude, graven image of a human brain. So, just maybe, because we've seen warnings of late. Science fiction's been talking for years about the event, the quickening when science finally gets to the point where we can create a godlike brain, a bioengineered cyber brain. We can mix genetic DNA type material with electronic material, make it faster, better, smarter. Oh, and then we'll be able to fall down on our knees and worship it because it will tell us how to fix the social, the economic problems that we've created. You want to see where this trap ultimately leads to the ultimate kind of bondage? I think that's exactly what this portion is laying out. Moshe is, I think, I'll put it this way, in the wider span of history. All right, you folks, you fall into this trap. Ultimately, we're going to have the split, northern and southern kingdom. Israel, going to go into bondage, out there whoring. And Judah, out there whoring, back into bondage. Welcome to Babylon, Medo-Persia, on into Greece and Rome. All these various captors and bondage, 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 cycle after cycle after cycle. But guess what? Comes a time when you think those were bondage, you think those were idols that the Greeks worshipped, that the Romans worshipped, that the Norse worshipped. Let me show you an idol. How about a brain? How about a cyber intelligence? How about a, what was it was called in the Terminator? Skynet. The Terminator robots, all of these kind of things. You know what? There's an element of truth in all of that stuff. Let me go back now and read verse 30. From Moshe's prophecy, there in chapter 4. You will serve other gods, he says. The work of men's hands, wood and stone. Well, from stone, from wood, you take a little bit of a mixture of the clay, the soil, the DNA from Adam, add some cellular structure from the wood, create something which certainly appears to have eyes, but it hears not, ears, or eyes, but it sees not, ears, but it hears not, doesn't do any of these things. Oh, I wouldn't worship that. I don't worship my Christmas tree. I don't worship any of this stuff. Folks, we're entering a period of time where the news is fixing to tell you when Big Brother says Ebola is coming to a theater near you, fall down on your knees, bend over, and put your butt up in the air so we can jab you with a little bit of synthetically engineered DNA so that you can hopefully live as a result of the synthetically engineered toxin that we have unleashed through our either stupidity or downright evil on a world. Is this an exaggeration? I'm going to suggest not. You want to see worship? Oh, yeah. What is Moshe fixing to say? There you shall serve other gods, the work of men's hands, DNA, cell structure, wood, stone, and other things that fall into one or the other of those two camps. And from there, he says, finally, just maybe, hopefully, prayerfully, from thence, verse 29, I'll read it straight in the English, you will seek Yahuwah Eloheka,
and you shall find him. If you search after him with all your heart and with all your soul. Yeah. Repetition in the Brit Hadashah says, seek and you will find. In your distress, when all of these things are come upon you, in the end of days, aha, see, I don't know if we're there yet, but I think we can see it from here. Then you will return to Yahuwah Eloheka, and again, do what? Shema, hearken unto his voice. He is merciful. He will not fail you, nor destroy you, nor forget the covenant of your fathers, which he swore unto them. Know that. There is none else. In the meanwhile, problem? Because we have failed to do exactly what he says. Destroy the altars. They've been a trap. Break them down, dash them in pieces, hew down their asherim, burn the graven images with fire. How do you destroy an Ebola virus? How do you destroy a prion from us? Mad cow disease. Bovine spongiform encephalopathy. BSE. Turns out fire is the only way. Modern antibiotics, modern cleansing agents won't get it. Interesting. The more I study his Torah, the more I find out science doesn't have a clue. And as they think they're uncovering things, turns out he was warning us about certain stuff all along. Let's talk a little bit. Now, I guess I'll pause at this point, as I often do, and say, if we got questions, were there any questions that were particularly apropos on this one? And I'm interested in feedback, because I haven't taught about this or talked about this before. Actually, up until literally it was this morning when I was doing a little bit of praying and reviewing my notes, and I felt these words, essentially just this Deborim. Hey, ask it as a question. Has it ever occurred to you that DNA is his word too? What about the serpent on the pole? Does it represent the enemy's future? Yeah, maybe. I think in terms of what I'm looking at the enemy's future and seeing it, it's in chapter 7 as well, where it says that we're not to be afraid of them, and that those people who love him and keep his commandments, he is faithful to unto 1,000 generations, and that he will repay those who hate him to their face. And, may we live to see that day. But I guess all of this is both a caution and a warning. I think we're seeing, as cycle upon cycle plays out, and to my mind, the Ebola scare, the Ebola pandemic panic, begins to put a lot of this into perspective, and it shows. So think of it, if you will, of two different bookends for how this mucking by adding to and subtracting from his word ends up. Starts with a church that's been doing it for, at least 1,700 years, arguably a whole lot longer than that. The Pharisees primarily added to. The popes and priests have primarily subtracted from. You don't have to keep his feasts. Matter of fact, if you do, you're anathema to the church, and so forth. Whereas the Pharisees basically said, nope, it's not just a dozen things or so that are prohibited on Sabbath. We got 1,700 halacha things that we're going to add so that we're going to tell you what it means, how far you can walk, how much weight you can carry, and so forth. All kinds of silly stuff. That's adding to, and again, you don't have to do it, that's subtracting from. Of course, no fish on Fridays is probably adding to, as well as a whole bunch of other things. The examples clearly are legion. I do like the term that I saw online this morning. I'm going to keep it in mind. Not contradictions with Scripture, which they are, but it's more like contraditions. In other words, by your traditions you have made the commandments of Yah of no effect, is the way Yahushua put it. We got tons and tons of contraditions today, where we say our traditions, that wonderful tradition about Easter ham and eggs and bunnies. Yeah, that's what we like. We don't like Pesach anymore. What are we supposed to do with these things? Burn them with fire, break down the altar, dash in pieces, burn their graven images with fire. Burn the graven little chocolate bunnies with fire. There's an image for you. Okay,
Yeah, I see that coming on the screen from Whistler, and I will expand on that just a second, because I kind of alluded to it. Some people will know what I'm talking about. Lots probably won't. And his question, well, it wasn't so much a question as a comment. BSECJD. BSE, again, is bovine spongiform encephalopathy. This is mad cow disease. CJD, Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, after the people that discovered it. And it involves something. Now, some of you know there are cells that make up life, and there are bacteria, there are viruses. Viruses are, science for a long time has argued, are viruses alive or are they not? I think viruses are an interesting and really kind of evil. Maybe viruses are part of the death angel aspect, the destruction aspect. Certainly, that seems to be what they do, and they modify themselves. They almost have an evil intelligence with how they go about doing their work. But I guess that's particularly true if there are evil intelligences guiding and modifying them along the way. The point is, there are, in addition to those forms of life or cellular structures or however you want to call them, there are other things that replicate themselves. What is the definition of life as far as science is concerned? Well, it's something that replicates itself. Often it can move around. It has certain characteristics. Turns out that generally we associate that with some kind of a cell structure and with DNA. But in the case of prions, here we have something which is not really alive, but it also has the ability to replicate. And prions replicate chemically, physically even. They're like a puzzle piece. And when you put lots of prions together, they form a puzzle, and they link up like puzzle pieces in a jigsaw puzzle do. And then if there's little holes, the little holes in the puzzle piece have the form of another puzzle piece, right? You can kind of picture how that would work. If you got all the pieces in a puzzle except one or two in the middle, and now you put some material in there, a little clay, squoosh on it, you got another prion. Isn't that cute? Well, that's what this bovine spongiform encephalopathy is. And it turns out that what Creutzfeldt and Jakob and a couple of other folks, I think they got the Nobel Prize for it, discovered is, guess where this stuff came from? It came from cannibalism. Came from people eating things that aren't food. How clever. They were eating their ancestors, thinking, well, I eat Uncle Joe or Grandfather Tao's brain, and then I'll be smarter and I'll have his knowledge. What I'll have is bovine spongiform encephalopathy, or CJD. Basically, what it does, it looks a lot like Alzheimer's. It's a dementia. Kills people. And they found that when mad cows got mad cow, if you cut them open, their brains look spongy. And by the way, how do mad cows get mad cow? Well, you take a cow, which God made to be an herbivore, has three stomachs, chews the cud, has a split hoof, right? Processes veggies, turns into food, meat that you can eat. Nice clean meat. How can you turn a cow into a unclean thing? Answer, feed it other cows, turn it into a carnivore, turn it into something that eats something that God said it wasn't designed to eat. It's what rendering plants do, and it's what a lot of this so-called high-protein food does. It's an interesting commentary, the whole thing on how it is we take things that were created for our good, and by twisting his instruction, adding to and subtracting from, we turn it into something which is no longer good for us and becomes harmful. Take food, turn it into not food. Well, hey, if you think we can do that with bovine spongiform encephalopathy, a.k.a. mad cow, just wait till we talk about what Monsanto's doing with corn and canola and sugar beets. Oh, baby! We can turn animals into something that literally their intestines no longer are good enough even to make sausage out of. And we can destroy people's immune system in the process and make them more and more vulnerable to all kinds of other additions to and subtractions from and graven images, things with mutated, monstrous DNA. I mean, the whole thing, again, the more I think about it, the more I start to reread some of these scriptures and put them in the context of what we now know about science and asking questions. Hey, that line is in the blood, the life is in the blood. I mean, it's interesting. I remember having been fascinated when I first read it years and years ago and thinking, you know, there's more to that. And God said, let there be light. Same thing. There's more to that. And I later discovered there's a lot more to Genesis, Bereshit 1:1 than I understood at first. It's almost a mathematical representation. Again, it's Devarim. It is fascinating how our Creator can encode in His Word
more information than we ever believed or understood was there. But the more we learn, too much is given, much is expected, the more we learn, the more we're able to go back and say, look at that, it was there all along. And I'm again suggesting DNA similar. The life is in the blood. Don't make a graven image, a likeness. Well, maybe, just maybe, those ancient Hebrew words will have a little bit greater meaning and understanding at this point. Let me introduce where I'm going with the rest of this today as we talk about the news and come out of her, and in particular, of course, where can we take and apply some of these things that we're seeing today? What do they mean? Let's start with this line from Exodus 15:16. This, again, is another place where we're seeing similar stuff. Moshe is talking to the people, passing along the words of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. And in this case, this is after the waters of Meribah. He cried out, "What shall we drink?" People are asking Moshe. He cried out to Yahuwah, who showed him a tree. He cast it into the bitter waters. They were made sweet. And he said, "If you will diligently heed the voice of Yahuwah Eloheka and do what is right in his sight..." Does this sound familiar? "Give ear to his commandments and keep," Shema, "all of his hukim, I will put none of the diseases on you which I have brought on Mitzrayim, on the Egyptians. Ani Yahuwah Rapha. I am Yahuwah Rapha, who heals you." Well, in my mind, folks, the whole summary of how we deal with the Ebola panic pandemic and all of the graven images that are probably being created in a lab but are certainly being spread around the world right now so that somebody can make a whole hell of a lot of money pushing a vaccine. Whether it works or not is the interesting point here. It doesn't matter, right? Because if people are mandated to take it, a lot of them are going to get down on their knees and bow themselves before that Elohim of modern medicine. Yeah, put it in my blood. Mess with my DNA. Inject a little bit of live Ebola right on into my stream. You want an image of falling down before and serving another god? Maybe there you go. On the other hand, if we will diligently heed his voice and do what is right in his sight and hear his statutes and judgments and commandments, then he will, because he is Yahuwah Rapha, put none of these diseases, the ones that he brought on Mitzrayim, or in fact, he tells us later, others too, maybe others that were designed since then, or maybe others that were just rediscovered. I want to read one other section as we turn into this. We'll come back to this one as well. But this is another one of these places from the prophets that just seems to really kind of leap off the pages today and say, hey, yeah, it was appropriate then when the prophets said it. It's been appropriate at several points in the cycle since then. Guess what? Ain't nothing changed. Still appropriate today. Yeshayahu, Isaiah chapter 30, says, "Woe to the rebellious children," says Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, "who take counsel, but not of me, and who devise plans," you can hear them cackling, can't you? "But not of my spirit, that they may add sin to sin, who walk to go down to Egypt, and who have not asked my advice, to strengthen themselves in the strength of Pharaoh and to trust in the shadow of Egypt. Therefore, the strength of Pharaoh," maybe we would say the emperor nowadays, his almighty highness, commander-in-chief, or whatever term is the appropriate one for those who are above the law, "trust in the shadow of Egypt. Therefore, the strength of Pharaoh shall be your shame, and trust in the shadow of Egypt shall be your humiliation." I don't know about you, but to me that says, wow. Sure does fit, doesn't it? Okay. Let's talk about, again, some of the things in the news this week. I picked this one last night. I'm going to pick it again today because it just... the more things change, the more they stay the same. The old joke, how can you tell when a politician, when a lawyer, you know, fill in the blank, is lying? Answer,
Their lips are moving. Here's one. This week, the Tokyo Electric Power Company, TEPCO, shocked the world by saying, hey, the meltdown was even worse than we lied about the last time when we admitted it was even worse than we lied about the time before that, which was even worse than we lied about before that, which was even worse than the original set of lies. When are they starting to tell the truth? I don't think they're telling the truth yet. But it turns out, yeah, they've now admitted, this is years now after the fact, you know, we said it was perfectly safe. You're dead already. You're walking dead. The plant number 3 reactor. Also, every single fuel rod in there suffered a complete meltdown and dropped onto the floor of the containment vessel. They're still not saying it melted through. Others are saying they're liars. In any case, it's going to make it tougher to decommission. So, you know, you see this, the headline says, Fukushima nuclear meltdown worse than initially reported. My response is, you know, say what? Oh, come on. Whoa, there's a shocker. Here's another one. 3 out of 4 illegal immigrant juveniles from Mexico who are apprehended at the border are repeat offenders. Imagine that. Whoa, you're going to tell me that those that have gang tattoos all over them that show how many people they've killed. That's the little teardrops, in case you're curious, in the case of at least, I forget if it's Zetas or MS-13. So tough to keep the different gang members separated nowadays. But the point is, they just come across the border because there's nobody stopping them. At least not very often. 1 in a fraction. 3/4 of them repeat offenders. And the ones with gang tats that show they're murderers are almost certainly murderers. Oh, and by the way, you think just maybe they could be carrying Ebola? Or MERS or SARS or who knows what other kind of diseases, along with drug-resistant TB and scabies and all kinds. Of course they are. Not all of them, but enough. Just takes a few, you know. In spite of all the hype about shutting down air traffic around the world, you notice that they're not telling you the truth about that particular score. And I got 2 stories here that I'm going to talk about with respect, well, actually a couple more, just with respect to economics and some of the other things, again, to put the week in perspective. Remember, dishonest weights and measures, too. A violation of Torah, an abomination before Yah. It's called an abomination. Here's a piece. There's actually, both of these actually are from David Stockman. Now, if you know who David Stockman is, he's former Reagan-era budget director. And here's one of several folks that are fairly high-profile nowadays, and then they get interviewed a lot, at least by the Austrian economists of the world, because having been insiders, they kind of carry a special gravitas now that they're actually coming out and saying, you know what, we screwed up big time. But we didn't screw up bad as these current guys are. Stockman's headline from King World News, this is literally, I saw this yesterday, expect historic and worldwide financial destruction. Like Paul Craig Roberts, former Assistant Treasury Secretary, he's been coming out and just laying it on the line. He says, well, the watchword at this point is to stay out of harm's way. We are headed into a perfect storm of policy failures. Now, specifically, number one here, he's talking about economics, but it goes deeper. This is not, he says, simply a failure by the Fed, which has inflated this massive bubble. It's painted itself into a corner with no clue how to get out. But we're also seeing an absolute failure of American world dominance. Our foreign policy is collapsing everywhere. And yet the Washington War Party, and by that he means both wings of that R and D bird of prey, both wings of the war party keep wanting to do the same thing. This confrontation with Putin, he says, is utterly out of hand and unnecessary. Now we have a trade war, too, going on. It's going to ricochet through an already fragile European economy. We'll come back to that in just a second. I got another story from about 2 days ago. We hear now that Obama is considering going back into Iraq. Well, the story was that they did some bombing, and then basically others are saying, yeah, this was kind of like think Vietnam. They bombed for show. But they didn't bomb anything of actual value. In other words, they bombed an abandoned machine gun or an abandoned artillery piece or something like that. Basically, just for show. Just so that they could claim they're doing it. Remember, these ISIS folks are the very same people that the CIA armed and trained. Now, they won't admit that they armed them. They just happened to have left the world's best military hardware hanging around where they could get a hold of it. Isn't that special?
So he says basically things are ugly, and there are a number of factors, all of which he's laid out here, but you've heard them all before. I won't go through them. Will ultimately cause a major collapse. It's a question, he says, of when the black swan comes flying in, and when this confidence in the whole central banking illusion finally breaks down the markets. Train wreck, he says, is a pretty good term to describe what is coming. It's not very far down the road, and I can promise you that when it is, that is when all hell is going to break loose. I'll say something I've been saying now for a long time. We're beginning to see the pieces come together. Not just World War III. Not just the economic collapse. They'll come so fast, one after the other, that you won't be able to tell which is the cart, and which is the horse. And it looks like we're going to have a worldwide pandemic at about the same time, too, just to make sure people stay in their houses or in their concentration camps where they get sent. And if you don't think that's enough, well, remember, there's still EMP to consider as well. Oh, yeah, if it's necessary, there are so many hand grenades with the pins already pulled that they can drop any of them or all of them virtually simultaneously. Second piece from the same source, David Stockman. This is from the Contra Corner blog. I saw it on Zero Hedge. He quotes the late great critic of the American Imperium, Chalmers Johnson, who popularized the concept of blowback. And said, basically, if you bomb, drone, invade, desecrate, and slaughter, collaterally or otherwise, a people and their lands, then they might eventually find a way to return the favor. So he points to the mayhem being visited now on much of Iraq by American tanks, American armored personnel carriers, American heavy artillery, American anti-aircraft batteries, and other advanced weaponry that has, shazam, just happened coincidentally, to fall into the hands of the very same jihadist radicals that have been the ostensible target of Washington's entire multi-trillion dollar war on terrorism. Now, again, I'm quoting Stockman. No question about it, he says. The ISIS terrorists are winning against the hapless Iraqi and even the formidable Kurdish Peshmerga fighters using some of the most lethal arms that the U.S. military-industrial complex could conduct. So I ask a question I've been asking at some length for a while now. Is this an accident? Is it stupidity or is it just downright evil? Of course, Stockman says none of this was supposed to happen. You can look up the speeches. George W. Bush gave the speeches. Obama's given the speeches saying that, yes, you know, we are nation building. We're doing all this kind of stuff. Except, he notes, Iraq was never a nation. Even the Ottomans knew that you don't pull or attempt to put Shiites and Sunnis and Kurds in the same parliament, much less the same police force, certainly not the same army. Hang on just a second. Okay, so things look like we're okay. We're online, pal, and everywhere else. So where were we before we were so evilly interrupted by probably some of the very same people that we're talking about here? Back to David Stockman. By the way, the title of this story is Washington Has Opened the Gates of Hell in Iraq. Now, here come the Furies. And what he was saying basically was even the Ottomans knew you don't put all these folks, Sunnis, Shiites, and Kurds in the same parliament or police force, not certainly in the same military or army. And basically the boundaries that were drawn by the Sykes-Picot Agreement created the historic illusion, he said, of a nation that was called Iraq, that it actually existed. But, of course, in history it's not, and what you have now is ISIS trying to change the names back. They want to rename places like Nineveh and so forth, too. And they want to call it the Islamic Caliphate State. And so you have these neocons, as Stockman calls them, who, for no discernible national security reason, are looking, by God, he says, to have regime change. But what those fools, he said, did was to open the gates of hell. I'm not so sure they're fools, folks. I think probably what this is evil done on purpose. Now, he says, the Furies have come. Ironically, the bloodthirsty ISIS is comprised of fighters who were first enabled by the misbegotten Bush maneuver known as the Surge, then armed and trained by the CIA for the campaign against Assad. Remember, they couldn't get World War III started there by trumping up a false flag chemical weapons attack. And now, those same ISIS jihadists brandish the best weapons that any ramshackle jihadist group ever had.
I guess the comment that I remember, again, from Yeshua, a house divided against itself cannot stand. Remember, the forces of evil are happy to do that. That's what we see in time after time when it comes to, the Hegelian dialectic. Problem, reaction, solution. Thesis, antithesis. Play both sides of the fence. Create a problem. Pretend you didn't do it. And then pretend to be the savior and fix it. And in the process, give yourself more power than ever. Back to other attempts at World War III. There's this one this week. Russia has finally responded to the sanctions. They banned all U.S. food imports. They are the number two importer of poultry. No more. And they've banned fruit and vegetables from the European Union. The Kiev government has even fired a shot into its own foot and reloaded. They're threatening, I don't know if they've actually gone the rest of the way yet, to ban Russian natural gas from coming across through the Ukraine. Oh, yeah. That'll teach the allies in Western Europe whose side the U.S. is on. You can't believe that this kind of stuff is actually what's happening, but it is, and it just basically shows you what's going on. Other related story, Russian bombers admit the United States military have now penetrated, this is a day old, the U.S. ADIZ, or Air Defense Identification Zone, at least 16 times in 10 days. They called it a surge, or a spike, in the number of attempts. Just maybe there's something more going on here than the usual training missions. Meanwhile, remember MH17? Well, the news media doesn't seem to. Why? Well, it served its PR propaganda purposes, and now it turns out that people are realizing it was a lie all along. We got story, I did most of this last week, so I won't repeat it. OSCE investigators that were locked out for a while, but they finally managed to get in and see the wreckage. Turns out it's full of machine gun bullet holes. At least that's what they look like. 30-millimeter cannon happens to be on the Ukrainian Su-25. Russian radar images and other witnesses show at least one, maybe two of them, very near proximity to MH-17 before it was shot down, maybe. Not necessarily a missile. The only people that have the book missile system that the U.S. government accused the Russians but never did manage to come up with a single piece of real evidence to support, well, the only true book missile systems were owned by the Kiev puppet government. And yet there's not a single eyewitness that I've ever seen or, for that matter, has ever been reported on that came forward and said, we saw a missile. So maybe it was shot down. So what's happened now is the scenario shifts. It's abundantly clear, said a story from Tony Cartolucci, that truthful resolution to the tragedy of the downed Malaysian Airlines Flight 17 was never the goal of Washington or London or Brussels. It was all about propaganda, and now that the narrative has been pretty well debunked and sanctions are in place anyway, and war is ever closer, right? You know, it served its purposes. The scenario is shifting, and the news media is pretending, what? MH17? Never heard of it. Meanwhile, speaking of other things that they never heard of, how about the open borders on the south side? This, to my mind, is probably the biggest in-your-face contradiction in a number of years. You, when you go through an airport, are going to have your gonads groped and your children microwaved because you can't be trusted. You might get on an airplane with a bottle of shaving cream or a can of mother's milk or a bottle of mother's milk. Not permissible. On the other hand, when it comes to Ebola or MERS or SARS or scabies or, you know, fill in the blank with the disease, we'll leave the southern borders wide open and tell people to be afraid, be very afraid that somebody might slip in on an airplane, but don't worry about tens or hundreds of thousands streaming across the southern borders, including evidently whole bunches from countries like Nigeria, Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone. Interesting. Turns out, by the way, I thought this was an interesting statistic I saw this week. 90% of the few who are apprehended and given a court date, 90% of them, oh, they do, by the way, get a bus ticket usually too, they never show up for their immigration hearing either. No contradiction there. Here's where I'm headed. This is going to tie back into the Torah portion and to the issue of who is Yahuwah Rapha and who is not. This got hyped all out of proportion earlier in the week. I saw a piece, Zero Hedge does some interesting stuff on, you know, what's moving in the stock markets. It's primarily an economic site, but they do talk about other things as well.
company called MAP Pharmaceuticals. There are several companies that are in the news that all have the possibility of making billions of dollars if they hype up the Ebola situation enough and then get their drug, their vaccine approved first. Here's the story. This comes from Sanjay Gupta of CNN. And it says, experimental drug probably saved the two American high-profile Ebola patients. Dr. Kent Brantley, remember him? He was the first one that was admitted to be shipped back into the United States. First time the United States had ever voluntarily shipped one of the, arguably the most deadly human pathogen in human history, into its borders. Into Emory Hospital in Atlanta. And the ZMAP vaccine was given to these two people. ZMAP, by the way, is an experimental vaccine. Now, normally this would be considered unethical. If you're dying of cancer and saying, please, please, can I have an experimental treatment that might save my life because I'm dead anyway? Answer, no. FDA would not ever allow those particular short circuitings to happen. But, yeah, you know, if it's high enough profile and you got the right connections, the law is merely an impediment, not a barrier. On Thursday, says CNN, Dr. Kent Brantley thought he was going to die. It was the ninth day since he came down with Ebola in Liberia. His condition was worsening by the minute. He called his wife to say goodbye. But thank God, well, not really, thank the Ebola wonder workers. The call was premature. He's back on his feet, literally, after he received a last-ditch, highly experimental drug. Another American missionary, Nancy Reitbol, got the same thing, and doctors are calling it a miracle. The experimental drug is known as ZMAP, developed by biotech firm MAP Pharmaceuticals. Patients were told that this treatment had never been tried, but hey, what else can you do? Miraculous thing happened. Oh, the other miraculous thing was ZMAP's stock price, I guess, or at least the Wall Street response was overwhelming. Guess what? People think this is the second coming, I guess, to put it literally. Bottom line, somebody managed to get a really high-profile workaround in place. We have various laws, various ethical things that this is not supposed to happen. Remember, we have thousands of people die every day and complain about the fact that there's an untreated drug that might save my life. I know personally, haven't met them personally, but I certainly could name several doctors, Hudgens is one of them, and others, people with cancer treatments and other things, that have literally been forced to flee, Hudgens, the United States, and go into places like Mexico, or even Costa Rica, because they're allowed to do things there that octung are verboten in the United States. But if you have the right connections, again, the law doesn't really matter. Isn't that convenient? That's going to fit with where I'm headed. Here is the next big thing to be afraid, be very afraid of, says Mike Adams, Natural News Editor, Health Ranger. The possibility of Ebola being harvested by would-be terrorists. Hey, if we can give ISIS military weapons, why can't we leave bodies laying in the streets of Lagos, Nigeria, or Sierra Leone, or any number of places? There's bodies all over the places. Over there, all a terrorist got to do is go in, put on their nice mask and gloves, and scoop them up. Hey, if you get exposed, well, you just strap on some bombs and go to New York. Or come across the southern border and go to Houston. I wish that was a sarcastic comment again. Back to Natural News. The possibility of using even the low-tech option as a bioweapon is now at the front of the minds of many. Dr. Peter Walsh, University of Cambridge, has publicly raised the alarm over the same thing that Natural News and others have been pointing out for some time, saying Ebola is the perfect bioweapon. Almost like it was designed that way, isn't it? Because of its ability to survive storage and still function many days, weeks, or even years later, it is easily harvested, or could be, from infected victims and preserved using nothing more than a common food dehydrator. Now, Dr. Walsh is adding his voice to the article that was published recently in The Sun, saying, quote, serious risk is that a group manages to harness the virus as a powder, then explodes it in a bomb in a highly populated public area. It could cause a large number of horrific deaths. Ebola is not difficult to acquire, even in the United States now, but even especially in those Western African countries. Now, let me ask a question, folks, seriously. Again,
It's not that you have to be an evil genius to figure this stuff out. It's obvious. And by the way, in the process of noting how easy this is, isn't it great because it gives plausible deniability to the people who are the evil geniuses that were creating these graven images of real DNA modified in the similitude, the likeness, the tamuna of something that God created for purposes of death and destruction, anti-Torah. It's real easy. They're telling us how it's done. Again, you don't have to be that smart to do it. And if a jihadist catches Ebola in the process, well, you know, before you show symptoms, just come on in! Obama's opened the borders! Everybody's welcome! They'll give you a bus ticket, for crying out loud, to go where you want to go! Just get there before the symptoms show, strap some stuff to your body, and blow yourself up in a shopping mall. You don't even have to do that. Just walk around shaking hands with everybody you can meet. Go buy some stuff. Try on some clothes. Spit on them. Urinate. It does not take any kind of brilliance to see how evil and insidious and easy all of that is. Ebola is easy to store in powder form, says Mike Adams. Not only that, it's stable. It will survive in liquid or dried material form for a number of days. Infectivity is stable at room temperature or at 4 degrees Celsius for several days, and it is indefinitely stable at minus 70 degrees Celsius. You just take the frozen, get this, blood samples, dry the blood samples with a freeze dryer, place them under vacuum to sublimate the water, yada, yada. Can you, again, let's hearken back to Torah. Life is in the blood. I guess death is in the blood, too. If you can create a graven image of the DNA, twist it, do a little gene splicing, put a little pig stuff in there, make it more easily replicated, more transmissible, make it so that the symptoms don't show, but it's still virulent for a while. Hey, it's a great bioweapon. Somebody worked really hard for this. No wonder CDC's got a patent on it. For crying out loud. Oh, and here's the thing that Adams points out, too. What makes Ebola such a great weapon is, unlike chemical weapons that require manufacturing facilities or tanks and guns that require some sophistication to produce, well, this one self-replicates. Yeah, it's the gift that keeps on giving. The terrorists who invoke such a weapon are not merely causing fatalities among those who are immediately infected. They also initiate a ripple effect that may result in hundreds, nay, thousands, even tens of thousands of others being infected before containment could be achieved. This one you've heard. I've already alluded to it. Rents.com this week has a piece by Yoichi Shimatsu saying that the Ebola strain has been linked to an African outbreak. The Ebola strain in the African outbreak has been linked to a lab escape. Yes, a medical research lab. And he points out that essentially the people have been shipping these tissue samples all over the place, infected tissue. Who ships it? Is it possible a plane could crash? Is it possible that terrorists could know that a shipment is coming and steal it en route from UPS or FedEx or whoever it is? Some doctors are a chief virologist at the Rocky Mountain Laboratory in Montana, for example. Dr. Heinz Feldman has urged a halt to international shipments of infected tissue because of the possibility of contagious pathogens being hijacked or accidentally released. Now remember, CDC alone in just the last few months has admitted something like, I think it was five, but maybe we're up to half a dozen or more at this point, accidental releases of everything from anthrax to other contagious deadly pathogens. Shazam, who'd have known we could screw it up that way? Well, these are the professionals, you know? And we're going to get to a point that that Mike Adams makes here in just a minute, too, about who you're going to believe, you know, me or your lying eyes. But anyway, back to the story quickly. Inefficient transport of medical supplies could explain, he says, why the current West African outbreak is not of the standard garden variety Ivory Coast Ebola, EBO-C1. Instead, the now prevalent virus is the foreign Zibov, or Ebola Zaire, the most virulent of the four known types of this pathogen. I don't know if they're counting the CDC patents in there or not. And how it is, he says, that one of the deadliest viral strains in human history could have jumped a distance of 4,000 kilometers, undetected, from Central Africa to West Africa defies logic. And it'll be difficult to trace down its path since they don't know who the infamous patient zero was
at this point. Anyway, here's the part where really the plot begins to thicken. This, again, is from Mike Adams. And comes in turn via Truth Stream Media. I know Zero Hedge has probably had this up. Prison Planet, InfoWars did. Aaron Dykes, Melissa Melton, had a bombshell story a few weeks back. And all of a sudden, it makes even more sense given recent Ebola revelations. It's entitled, The Edible Vaccine Inventor Jokes About Mass Genocide with GMO'd viruses. There's even a video, you can see it online, of a fellow who, I'm going to say it, an evil blankety blank. You don't joke about this, as Mike Adams points out. Dr. Charles Arntzen, head of the Biodesign Institute for Infectious Diseases and Vaccinology, was answering a question in a medical forum about how to kill off billions of humans to further the goal of global depopulation. From the audience, a fellow named Dr. Jason Robert asks him the following question. Should there really be 8 billion people in this world? Is there a limit on how many people the planet can sustain? Should we concern ourselves with feeding 8 billion people in the first place, or should we allow natural forces of carrying capacity to affect or limit population growth? Now, here's the answer. Listen to this, and I'm going to do it with all the respect that it deserves. Quote, the developer of the Ebola vaccine, which has so far been tested only on mice, Dr. Arntzen responded thusly. Has anybody seen Contagion? He's talking about the movie. That's the answer. Go out and use genetic engineering to create a better virus. Audience loved it. They just ate it up. There's chuckles out there all over the place. Oh, this is funny stuff. 25% of the population, he said, is supposed to go in Contagion. And as Mike Adams points out, you know, when you got people that are supposedly creating viruses because of their love for saving lives, joking about killing 2 billion people with a genetically modified graven image made in the similitude of human DNA, or at least a viral DNA that attacks humans, something is horribly, horribly wrong. Human heart is desperately wicked, said Jeremiah. Who can know it? What's the goal here? Well, we're circumventing the law in order to get the high-profile propaganda out to people. Yes, we will fix it. The real God will come and save you from the dreaded, fearful Ebola. We created it. We unleashed it. Now we'll save you from it. Bend over on your knees. Put your butt in the air, and we will inject you with the real blood of life. The biblical analogy and the satanic overtones, I'm going to say it, it's satanic, folks. This is adversarial to everything that the creator of the universe says to do. Do they love him or hate him? I guess I'm going to leave that to the reader to decide, or the listener. But what we're seeing, though, are attempts to say we need a vaccine and we need it today. And by the way, we've already got quarantines set up. Isn't it wonderful? CDC has concentration camps all over the place ready to put people in. We talked about it last week. Obama has re-signed an executive order, just tweaked it a little bit, to say, hey, not only do we not need any evidence to kill you with a drone, if you even look healthy, but we think you might need to be in a concentration camp where you can all the better to catch Ebola, we'll put you there. Who's going to say no? We're going to disarm you anyway. Use the same pretext here. Can't have people saying no to us with guns, you know. The almighty Elohim that have created this thing are going to put you... What does the Bible say? You'll serve those who serve the false gods? Can you see it yet? Another one from Mike Adams. 21 questions about Ebola. These are good questions. And also things like government propaganda, medical corruption, and bioweapon experiments. Let me preface this with a piece that came out of the CDC chief, the head of the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, said before Congress, this was on Friday, that Ebola's spread to the United States is, quote, inevitable, unquote. But not to worry, we have the concentration camps already. It'll just be little outbreaks hither and yon, and we'll make sure that all the people we want to put away, Achtung, are put away. Zyklon B, folks. That was for pikers. Ebola is the real thing. That's a real graven image for you. Back to Mike Adams. Something's fishy, he says, you think, about the official stories we're being told on Ebola. They don't add up. So here are a bunch of questions. He's got 21. I'm not going to read all of them. You get the gist with just a few of the first ones. How, he asks, can U.S. health authorities claim there is zero risk from treating Ebola patients in the United States at hospitals when those very same hospitals can't control existing superbug infections? Right? We got all kinds of things. MRSA, C. diff, VRE, drug-resistant staphylococcus, for crying out loud. And they can't handle that. Quote, most hospitals are poorly prepared to contain any pathogen. That's why 75,000 people or more, said Fox News, die every year from hospital infections. If hospitals can't stop common infections like MRSA, C. diff, and VRE, they probably can't handle Ebola. Question number two. Why do we trust the CDC's handling of Ebola when the same miscreants can't even keep track of its own anthrax, avian flu, and smallpox samples? I would say that is a damn good question. Three, why were Ebola victims transported to cities in the USA when they could be given state-of-the-art medical care overseas? He quotes epidemiologist Dr. Michael Savage, PhD, I guess, who said, when you bring infectious patients into a nation that is Ebola-free, you're violating the primary rule of contagion, which is isolation. Here's a good question. Why is the same company working on Ebola vaccines, it's called Tecmyra, receiving money from Monsanto? Graven Image DNA creator extraordinaire. And it, by the way, considers Monsanto to be one of its important business partners. And by the way, along the same lines, why is that same company, Tecmyra, gotten $140 million from the Department of Defense on an Ebola-related contract if it's not a threat? Maybe it's because they want to turn it into a threat. I don't know. And by the way, if Ebola is not a threat, why has the Department of Defense deployed Ebola detection equipment to all 50 states? Now, I spent some time earlier this week talking about alpha and beta errors and basically saying, here's the problem with detection kits, especially when you have a nation of law that has turned into a nation of men. In other words, the law doesn't matter, right? Doesn't even slow them down anymore. Think about a detection kit. The detection kit has a function. It's supposed to say, we tested this person, they have disease X, or disease E in this case. Suppose the detection kit is wrong. You see, any good test designer can tell you this is what alpha and beta errors are. There's two ways to make a mistake. You can say that someone who has the disease doesn't. They go free. You don't put them in the concentration camp. Oh, don't worry about that. We'll just get everybody. That way we get them all. Why have the detection kit in that case? Okay. But the other way you can make an error with the kit is you can say that somebody that is clean and doesn't have anything has the disease. Those, again, are called alpha and beta errors. You say it's true when it's not, and you say it's not when it is. Guess what? If you were the one contracting for the Department of Defense to put this test in place, I guarantee you what they're going to say. They're going to tell you, the heck with the beta error. In other words, we don't care if you say that there's 1,000 people that have Ebola and we send them to the concentration camps and they're clean. No, we don't care about that. We want to make darn sure, because we're so concerned about your safety, that not one, I mean not one in 100 million people who the test says are clean aren't really clean. In other words, if you're going to make an error, for crying out loud, say they got Ebola. You see, it's the safe choice. It's the bureaucratic choice. Err on the side of caution and claiming the person has Ebola. What are we going to do? Well, we're going to take the clean people. Who knows how many that is? Maybe 1 in 10, 10%. Yeah, that's not a bad number. Then 10% we throw into the concentration camp that are really healthy anyway, but we say they have Ebola. Now, if we're claiming that 9 out of 10 people that we put in this camp have Ebola, what are the odds of the 1 in 10 persons all over the place, the tens of thousands we're going to put in the camp, eventually catching Ebola from the other people we're sticking them in there with? Answer? You know it as well as I do. We're sentencing them to death because of a test that is wrong. So here's the bottom line. This is where I'm going to quit and go to another story. How can we trust, asks Mike Adams, a government to tell us the truth about Ebola when that same government repeatedly lies? Think Fukushima. How about swine flu? That was the last Be Afraid, Be Very Afraid epidemic. Swine flu. Engineer a pig virus, make it more
Yeah, you get the idea. Influenza, Fukushima radiation, weapon control, weather control technology, the security of the borders, Benghazi, you know, IRS, dog ate my emails, you name it. We can't trust them to tell anything that is true, period. Follow the money? Well, there's billions to be made here. Follow the power? There's control like never before exercised here. Do you think they'd lie? You can bet your life on it. On to where things really get ugly, if you didn't think they were ugly so far. What is it that Moshe said? Keep his statutes and judgments and commandments. How are you supposed to deal with these idols of the land? Burn them, dash them, break them in pieces, hew down their asherim, smash them, make no covenant with them. What happens? Well, you get kicked out of the land. Already got that one covered. And you go into bondage to those who serve these other gods. Years ago, there was a TV show called House, M.D. I remember watching it. I thought it was interesting. It was very well done, very well acted and written. But it really kind of showcased what I would call the doctor as God mentality. Dr. House was an atheist. He was also brilliant. He cured people that nobody else could cure. They would have died for sure, but for his intervention. And you know what? He believed he was God. He was godlike in his power. You want an example of a show that'll teach you about other Elohim and the kinds of people that look in the mirror and see that they are in fact God? There's the example. And when I think about, you know, the bookends, the book of Exodus, the 10 plagues that during the greater Exodus yet to come will get revisited, I can't help but think somewhere up close to the top of the list is Elohim Rapha, the God of Washington, or the CDC, Atlanta. You know, you name it. These other Elohim mighty ones that they believe they hold the power of life and death. They can create graven images based on DNA. They can modify corn, soybeans, and men and make them better. Now I'm hearkening to Malcolm Reynolds in a movie called Serenity, if you ever saw that. Great film. Best sci-fi series ever filmed. He points out, you know, the essence of this evil empire that they were fighting in this sci-fi drama was a government that thought they could make men perfect. You can be like gods, I guess is the way you could put it. It's the essence of the two biggest lies ever. Oh, you will not die either. Why? Well, because we can modify your DNA. We can make men better. What is the biggest threat, you might be thinking, with all of this stuff going on? What are the things that really matter in Washington? Well, we had a African U.S. leaders summit this week, and of course, Biden was there, and Obama was there, and the president's men were there. And they were telling the African leaders, you got to drop this God of the Bible stuff, in particular, you know, we now know better, and we're going to elevate LGBT rights to a sacrament. So that was one of the things on the agenda. Turns out the other one had to do with Obama saying, you wouldn't want me twiddling my thumbs, would you? No, I've got emperor stuff to do. And then we have this. Here's the real threat. The number one domestic terror threat in the United States, according to the Department of, say it with me folks, Achtung, Homeland Security. They have a new national consortium. Two that is working with their funding called the Study for Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism, START. And they've identified the real threat. Is it Ebola streaming across the open borders? Is it tyranny in uniform, armed with weapons the likes of which the peons cannot possess? Is it lying in government, Benghazi, giving arms to ISIS, the threat that the jihadists might represent? Is it even Ebola? No, it's none of those. It is domestic terror in the form of sovereign citizens. You may never have heard this if you hadn't watched CBS and gotten their propaganda from the Southern Poverty Law Center. By the way, law is sick in that one. The Southern Poverty Law Center is part and parcel of this particularly evil propaganda movement, too. They estimate there are 100,000 Americans who are hardcore sovereign believers. Now, by the way, folks, what are we really talking about here? Let me give you another story that won't use the
media buzzword, sovereign citizen. It says the Department of Just Us is reviving their own law enforcement group. They've been pushing this a lot lately. And it is gearing up to fight the domestic terrorists that they note include the following. Maybe you've heard of these groups. Constitutionalists, Christians, libertarians, and of course anybody that believes that the God of the Bible is the real God and that their fake Elohim in Washington aren't. Here's another story that says, this is just a headline. U.S. law enforcement is clearly prepping for a domestic emergency, and they're stockpiling M16 rifles by the thousands. Again, the target, the issue, not MERS-infected people coming across the border, and not jihadis armed with a bunch of Ebola that they dehydrated from the blood of somebody that died in West Africa, and then ate, and then came across the border so they can go to a shopping mall and either blow themselves up or just walk around and infect as many people as possible. No, none of that. It's the so-called sovereign citizens and constitutionalists and Christians and libertarians and, I would dare say, probably Torah observant believers in there too. This piece makes the case, UN and feds, it says. By the way, the UN WHO, World Health Organization, declared Ebola an international emergency the other day. It's only like the third one in history, and they said basically we got to pull out the stops now. This is from Alex Newman at the New American. Basically with a little bit of review of the Ebola outbreak sweeping across West Africa, concerns, he says, are spreading in the U.S. about how state and federal authorities would react. Now, we know it's when, not if, according to CDC. Ebola begins to spread. Global responses are also stirring fears. WHO is already making waves with its controversial global preparations. And, of course, in the United States, you have the Executive Order 13295 signed last week, which says we can put you in a concentration camp, even if you look healthy, based on suspicion. One more point, and then I go to the big conclusion here. Leaked documents they may have come from Edward Snowden, they may have come from somewhere else, but they're classified documents that show that the terror no-fly watch list has grown in size by a factor of 10 since Obama took office in 2009. They reveal that last year there were over 47,000 names on the list, and that there's another related list which is much bigger still. With all kinds of names of people that are, you know, first on the list to get put aside when things get ugly. I've got one more place that we want to go here in a second. Second database. This is just a leak. This comes from Thomas Edlam, again, New American. Glenn Greenwald reporting that government spy agencies are now tracking more than not just the 47,000 or probably 50,000 by now plus on the no-fly list, but more than 1 million people. They've been scooping up driver's licenses under Real ID Act and all kinds of other things in preparation for what is coming. Expect the number to be in the tens of millions very soon. Because there are no legislative curbs to prevent them from deciding all of these people need to be watched. Now, let me ask a question. If they can already take people who show no symptoms and put them in a concentration camp where they will soon be guaranteed to show symptoms, and they've already got over 1 million names on the list, that's about 1 in 300 Americans, soon to be who knows how many times that, what's to say that they simply can't start taking anybody they want and putting them in concentration camps and giving them Ebola? If they die for some other reason, who's going to know? Who's going to go in and find out? The human heart is desperately wicked. Who can know it? What if they make it mandatory? Now, this is where I was headed to. What if they make it mandatory, asked Michael Snyder, for Americans to take the Ebola vaccine? Hey, if you own the company, ZMAP, Tecmyra, Monsanto, you know, fill in the blank, those who make graven images and profit greatly by getting people to bow down and take the life that's in their particular blood, in preference to whatever they might have had from Yahuwah Rapha, If they can force that on people, a whole lot of people are going to say, yeah, give it to me. I want it. You can guarantee, folks, there are going to be people, this is part of the propaganda effort here, demanding, I need it, I want it now, you got to give it to me. Give it to me. So Snyder asks, what will you do if they make the vaccine mandatory? And by the way, do you trust them anyway, for crying out loud? That's kind of what I'd call a really stupid question. If their lips are moving, they're probably lying. If you wanted to identify a sovereign citizen, let me suggest a test. Here's back to the alpha and beta errors. Is somebody a sovereign citizen? Well, I know. Hey, here's an easy test. Stop them at a roadside checkpoint. We Americans have been conditioned to that now for several years. And tell them, we think there may be Ebola around here somewhere. We have no proof, but we don't need proof, remember? And you better drop trow and bend over, because we are going to inject you with the vaccine. Oh, thank you, sir. May I have another? That's what some will say. And on the other hand, if it's a sovereign citizen or a constitutionalist or a Bible believer of any sort or a libertarian, they may say no. Well, right there, you got all the proof you need. They won't take the vaccine. They're obviously a terrorist. Obviously, they don't trust in the almighty Elohim of Big Brother. You know, there was a time where I would have said that what I'm doing is exaggerating for effect, making the point. Folks, that's no longer true. The line really is that bright, and it's that clear. And it's just as likely, more than likely, that this is exactly how it very well may play out. When the vaccine becomes mandatory, those who will not take it, by definition, are constitutionalist, libertarian, sovereign citizens. Even if you don't know what the word sovereign citizen means, that doesn't matter. If you were an honest, good, non-domestic terrorist American, the kind with a K that worships our God, then you'd have bent over when we said so. Got a piece here that we don't even probably need to go through at this point by Daisy Luther, the organic prepper, why I won't be lining up for the Ebola vaccine, she says. Call me crazy. There's no way to know the long-term effects of the vaccine. Gee, do you think? They're already short-circuiting the testing. They've already approved genetically modified frankenfoods that turn out to give cancer and tumors in mass to rats. They only ran the test for a few months, you see, and it turns out that it takes like T+1 days for the tumors to start to take over the rats. Well, you don't care. We're going to inject live Ebola virus into tens or hundreds of millions of people? No, can't imagine there being any side effects from that. This is the gang that couldn't shoot straight, for crying out loud. What if the vaccine, here's the real kicker, has deliberate side effects? By the way, I would honestly tell people, I don't know a single person nowadays that I think has a Torah obedience streak in them that would voluntarily bend over for a flu vaccine. But if you've ever taken one before, repent now is my suggestion. This is just me speaking as Mark. Yeah, you don't have to take that advice. But certainly that's what I would tell all my loved ones. For crying out loud, you don't know what's in it. What you do know is in it is probably thimerosal, which is a.k.a. mercury, and maybe various kinds of who knows what serum are in there. Could there be other things floating around in there too? Could there even be deliberate poisons in there? You got vaccine developers saying they want to kill 2 billion people, rubbing their hands together. Ha ha ha. Isn't it funny? We're so much better than those peons. We deserve to live, they don't. That's how come we got our hidey holes, they get the concentration camps. I'll say it again, the human heart is desperately wicked. Who can know it? We're talking about some really, really nasty stuff today. And I'm not even going to go through the last piece because I think, I'll mention it briefly. This is again from Daisy Luther. What you need to do, preparing for an Ebola lockdown. No one comes in, no one goes out. What she says, this is basically good advice anyway, that's why I figure it's worth mentioning. Can you go into lockdown mode if the Ebola virus, or even the threat of the Ebola virus, right? How would you know if it's real? If they tell you people are dropping. I've pointed to the old movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind, where Richard Dreyfuss knows they're going to fake a chemical attack to keep people out of an area they don't want them seeing what's in there. That's where he wants to go, of course. They kill his chickens that he was using to see whether there might be a toxin around or not. It's a great ruse. The point, again, how will you know? Because they lie. How will you know what's in the vaccine? How will you know if what you're seeing on the news is even true? People are dying. Do you know whether it was Ebola that killed them or some other toxin or maybe something that was in the vaccine? Most people aren't going to even be willing to try to go in. We got journalists today, and I put that term in great big quotes, that get all of their information from the White House. They don't bother to go out and find out what the truth is anyway. You think they're going to go to an area where they might get Ebola? Who are you kidding? I need to go get the movie Contagion. Let's put it on the list and go read it. This woman says, too, you better watch it with your older children. See how the movie is basically prophesying about what is to come. But the government, she says, seems really excited about producing that untested vaccine, profiting to the tune of millions. Remember, CDC has their own patents, and jabbing all of us with it. So you may not get a lot of warning before things get really bad. Consider what we're seeing now to be the warning. Be prepared to go into lockdown mode for at least 6 weeks. And basically what that means is if you need something, you better have it because you can't go out in public and get it. Usual lists of all the things that you need to have. But bottom line is no one goes in, no one comes out. And that means nobody. You literally need to be sure, you know, if there's immediate community, be watchful. They're saying that some of the doctors, underground medic, a woman wrote a story here saying social distancing is the only effective way to protect yourself from the outbreak of disease. I, by the way, don't buy that. But 100 miles is the buffer zone for defense and so forth. Well, when it comes to really protecting yourself, I'm going to suggest something you've probably already heard. Get rid of the con traditions. If you're still eating crap that is not food, quit it. When will you trust Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh to tell you what he designed you to eat? Pig is not food. Shellfish is not food. And any examination of the literature will tell you every single pandemic in human history, up until the point where they engineered them based on pigs, has come through pigs. The famous influenza, Spanish flu, early 1900s, and so forth and so on. GMO is not food either. GMO is a graven image with modified DNA created in the similitude, the likeness, the tamuna of something that's real. Talk about a fake Elohim. All right, I started with this. I'm going to end with it and wrap up. Now, if there's questions, again, I know there may have been a bunch. There's a bunch of text, obviously, that scrolled off the screen, so I've missed it. And put them back up again if there are. But I started with Isaiah chapter 30. Woe to the rebellious children who take counsel, he said, but not of me, who defies plans, but not of my spirit, so that they might add sin to sin. Verse 9 says, this is a rebellious people, lying children, children who will not hear the Torah of Yahuwah, who say to the seers, do not see, and to the prophets, do not prophesy to us right things. No, speak to us smooth things. Prophesy deceits. Oh, we just love that. The letter from Paul to Timothy says, yeah, they got itching ears. They'll heap to themselves the kind of people who tell them what they want to hear. Come on. I mean, there you go. Get out of the way. Turn aside from that path. They cause the Holy One of Israel to cease from before us, they say. So he says the following, because you despise this debar and trust in oppression and perversity, oh, and by the way, in graven images and people who masquerade as Elohim on TV and rely on them, therefore this iniquity shall be to you like a breach ready to fall, a bulge in a high wall, whose breaking comes suddenly, in an instant. And he shall break it like the breaking of a potter's vessel, broken in pieces. He shall not spare. There shall not be found among its fragments a shard to take fire from the hearth or to take water from the cistern. There's a whole lot of other interesting combinations of things in here that basically point out this is ugly stuff. Chapter 31 is entitled in my NKJV, The Folly of Not Trusting in God. I started by reading Exodus 15:26. Where do we put our faith, our trust? Answer, if you love me, keep my commands. Walk in obedience. Who is the real, the only Elohim? Who is Echad? And by the way, he is also our healer. He is who he says he is, Yahuwah Rapha. He promises, if we will walk in obedience to him, he will not bring these diseases upon us. I think I've got Isaiah 40 here too. I read that last night. And it's a comforting verse. I'll read it in the light of all this nasty stuff. Comfort, yes, comfort my people, says your Elohim. This is chapter 40, verse 1. Speak comfort to Yerushalayim and cry out to her that her warfare is ended, that her iniquity is pardoned, for she has received, past tense, from the hand of Yahuwah, double for all her sins. You know, the next verse is probably too. The voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare the way of Yahuwah, make straight in the desert a highway for our Elohim. Let's cut to the end of the chapter. A lot of bad stuff that we're seeing. A lot of bad stuff that we've seen in history. Been prophesied, all of it, exactly as we were warned about. But verse 31 says, but those who wait on Yahuwah shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. You know what? If you think about the Ebola symptoms, shortness of breath, muscle soreness, flu symptoms, bleeding from every orifice and internally, this sounds like a pretty good antidote, doesn't it? Mount up with wings like eagles, run and not be weary, walk and not faint. I read this, and I look at the things that are going on, and I see in particular this set of chapters in this book today. That says over and over and over again, do not try your Elohim. Do not make graven images. Learn his statutes and judgments and commandments. Teach them to your children. Diligently do, do, do. Shema, hearken and obey. Learn. Write them on the doorpost of your house. Put them before your eyes. Talk of them when you go in and when you go out so that you see them. When you beget children, teach them. We've been scattered. We've seen a lot of this stuff already play out. I'm going to suggest we're seeing the rest of it now. What are we supposed to do? Well, interestingly, we'll talk about this next week too, but the very next Parsha, after it says, in conclusion, what we already know, you shall therefore keep the commandments, the statutes, and the ordinances. Ha mitzvot. Ha hukim. Ha mishpatim. Well, when you do that, it's come to pass, because you hearken to these ordinances to keep them and do them, Yahuwah Eloheka shall keep with you the covenant and the mercy which he swore unto your fathers. He will love you and bless you and multiply. He'll bless the fruit of your body and of your hand, your corn. I think he means the real stuff, not the Monsanto Franken corn, and your wine and your oil, the increase of your cattle and the young of your flock, in which he swore to your fathers to give you. You'll be blessed above all peoples. And then it says this again. Isn't this amazing? Verse 15. And Yahuwah will take away from you all sickness. That seems pretty inclusive. And he will put none of the evil diseases upon Egypt, of Egypt. And by the way, it says this, which you know. Oh, yeah. We will. Upon you. But instead he will lay them upon all of them who hate thee. Don't serve their gods, he says again. All right. Questions, comments? Before we close today, we will pray again. I know that in terms of things that I've been doing for now, at this point, several months, things are coming to a head. We have people that would have been insiders even saying, hey, look at it, economically, politically, foreign policy-wise, it's not just the idiots that are running the team. Paul Craig Roberts comes out and says, this stuff that they're doing is insane. It's insane. Who would remember, we had a policy at one time called MAD, Mutual Assured Destruction. It was assumed that sane people wouldn't want to start a nuclear war. You would think sane people wouldn't want to develop deadly pathogens that can kill the whole world. Well, unless, of course, your goal is to kill a whole lot of people and in the process make billions of dollars. Because, well, as any good bioweapons researcher will tell you, we always develop the vaccine right along with the virus. You wouldn't want us to catch it, would you?
Besides, our funds are unlimited. We're getting paid by the U.S. taxpayer. Printed money. Who has to worry about it? Truly. The old Chinese proverb, interesting times. But it's worse than that. We're now beginning to see all kinds of things come together. Is it the end times? I'll say this again one more time, too. No, it's not. At least I don't know yet. Well, no, in hindsight, it might be. But I can't prove that. But I guarantee you, no fiat currency has ever survived. The United States dollar is really, really, really long in the tooth, and it won't last much longer. Certainly looks like that about the time that it crumbles into dust and people are at their local Walmarts wondering why they can't afford to buy anything on the shelves and they start getting upset, they're going to find that they're disarmed. And if they're uppity, they'll be put into concentration camps. And by the way, you're so afraid anyway of what's going on, you probably aren't going to go to the Walmart. And just in case all of that fails, we can shut off your power. Then you can see what you can do. Ugly comes in big masses. Remember what Deuteronomy, it's not Deuteronomy, it was a previous Torah portion. Deuteronomy, of course, talks about blessing and curses. Note that the blessings are wonderful. They'll come upon you. You won't be able to escape them. But the curses are even more numerous. And we're told in other places that 7 times 7 times 7. If you won't heed, it gets worse and it gets worse and it gets worse. Well, I'm not sure how many sevens we're up to now, but it's quite a few. So, separate yourself. Touch not the unclean thing. There you go. Another way of saying the same thing. Come out of her. Understand that those who serve the prince of this world have already got all kinds of plans in place. They make the giants, as I was talking about last week, of the time of Moshe, well, at least to our eyes anyway, look kind of not scary by comparison. Hey, viruses are downright invisible. They're scarier than any giant, although we may eventually see some of them too. Hey, who knows what's being done genetically in those labs? But I know that every single bit of this has been told to us. We have been warned. We are without excuse. We've been told, too, to come out of a so-called church or various denominations, 501c3 and other creations of a different Elohim. All of which are telling us, pay no attention to what it says in that book there that you got. Not any more than we pay attention to what you thought was the supreme law of the land. So, let us pray. Yahuwah Eloheinu, Yahuwah Echad, Abba, Father, we come before you. We ask that you would give us eyes to see and ears to hear. We pray that you'd give us wisdom, Father, too, and help us to be strong and of good courage, chazach, and to stand, to do, in short, all of those things that you tell us over and over and over again to do. Help us to veer neither to the right nor to the left, but to learn and understand, hear and obey and do, as best we can, all of your statutes and your judgments and your commandments. Help us, Father, to have the wisdom and the discernment to recognize truth from lies, because we can see the lies that are already thick and we know it's going to get worse. We know that the attempt is going to be to scare us, to scare your people, to divide our houses and families, and to kill us if possible. And we know that in our own strength we can't possibly stand against this particular evil that we're seeing. From the viruses to the economic meltdowns. None of us are rich enough or smart enough or strong enough. But you are. Because we know that you are who you say you are. And your promises are true. And you are the real, only Elohim. Our Yahuwah Eloheinu. And furthermore, you are Yahuwah Rapha, who heals all of our diseases. So we pray, Father, particularly for your protection in this time. Help us to come out, to be separate. Keep us safe from these things that are being unleashed. Help us to be counted worthy to escape all the stuff we can now see so clearly that's coming. Help us to be good and faithful servants. Help us to be ready. Help us to be speaking your truth boldly. And Father, we lift up those in our families, our loved ones, our wives, our husbands, or daughters, or sons, people we work with, any numbers of others, many of whom, Abba, are walking in outright rebellion. They might even hate you. At least they're walking in such a way that we can't tell. So we pray that you would heal their backslidings. Chasten them. Give them whatever it's needed, Father. You know and we don't. Bring witnesses to them. Hit them across the chops with a 2x4, Abba. Put a wall around them. Whatever it takes, Father, we pray that our loved ones would begin to see and teshuva, to turn, to return to you, whether they've ever been there or not, or whether they've backslidden and have turned away, and to come back. Because, Father, we know that something's coming, and we know that it's soon, and we know that we can use more hands to help. So bring our houses together, bring our families together, and our communities together, we pray. Help us to be found doing your work, all the things that you have for us, and to be ready. All this we ask in your name, by your authority, in accord with your word. And we declare that we know you are who you say you are. Yehuah Zevuot, Yehuah Nisi, Yehuah Vitzivenu, Yehuah Rapha. Hallelujah. Amen. Oh, okay. I guess this is an announcement that I'm supposed to make. Because we got some stuff happening next weekend, so Jeff and I will be swapping live time slots next week. So, the announcement says I'll be starting around 9 a.m. Mountain Time, Daylight Savings Time, and Jeff will go in the opposite direction, probably more like, depending, 11 o'clock or thereabouts, 10:30, 11, somewhere in that vicinity. So that'll be a one-time thing, I guess. In any case, any other questions, comments? I didn't see any. Again, I know that's a lot to digest, but I pray that those things that I have been led to say would be in accord with His Word. Test them for yourselves. Be like the Bereans. See if these things are true. Check them out against Scripture, because we are told we need to be able to study to show ourselves approved, rightly divide His Word. And if we haven't read it, and we haven't started at the beginning and built line by line, precept by precept, well, then we're subject to deception. May Yehovah bless you and keep you. Make His face to shine upon you. May Yehovah lift up His countenance upon you and give you His shalom. Amen.